If you don't stand for something, you will fall for anything. Stand 10 toes down in whatever it is that you believe. And then all of you activists and all of you people that are doing all of these causes, we need a social contract that says that we're going to become more nuanced. We're going to use the vocabulary that we throw around in terms of intersectionality and understanding and inclusion. And we're going to act like the internet is not just a place where you can say whatever you want and then dip out. We have to be able to talk to each other, and we need to be able to agree to disagree if that's what it comes to, because the other person, no matter how much you hate what they say, are going to exist anyway. You actually need to do the work to get there before you label someone as a thing.
Hi everyone, my name is Stephen Wakabayashi, and you're listening to Yellow Glitter, Mindfulness through the Eyes and Soul of Queer Asian Perspectives. This episode, we're joined by our ever-returning lovely guest, Jonathan Gibbs. Jonathan, pronounce he, him, is a pioneering content creator who began his journey in 2008 during the early days of YouTube. His unique perspective as a Black American and Filipino has made him a powerful voice at the intersection of Black and Asian identity. Hosting various podcasts whose subjects range from being queer to being Blasian, Jonathan offers nuanced insights into the world through the lens of a queer person of color. In 2020, he founded the Black and Asian Alliance Network, promoting solidarity between these communities during a time of heightened tension. Recognized with the Brooklyn Free Speech Award, Jonathan is a passionate activist and trailblazer, making a lasting impact in the fight for social justice. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me yet again, Stephen. Here we are. It's like an annual event.
It is our annual event. And last time you were on, we were talking about the very popular Fire Island episode.
Oh.
Fire Island series, actually, not episode. Yes,
no, TV series. It was like it wasn't a TV series. It was a one-time movie.
It was a movie?
What? Yeah, on Hulu, wasn't it?
Yes, that I remember. So we talked about Fire Island, and since then, do you want to share with the audience what has been the reaction been like?
Well, I remember after that episode came out, like maybe, when did that come out? Was it like the winter of 2023?
I think it was earlier in the year.
I think it was like spring, because Fire Island didn't necessarily come out in the summer, or I could be getting that wrong completely. Anyway, it was quite some time after.
Yeah.
The episode that I was in a particular digital Gaijin space commenting on something completely not about Joel Kim Booster or the Fire Island movie.
Yeah.
When someone responded in the conversation like, oh, hey, I agree with you on whatever we're talking about. And by the way, I really enjoyed your podcast episode. I was like, well, first of all, it's not mine. It's my dear friend, Stephen Wakabayashi, Yellow Glitter. Go check it out.
It's all of ours.
But thank you for letting me know. And that's happened like two or three times throughout the year.
Oh, nice.
That and being the face of transphobia on the sexual harassment training for New York City and state, which apparently is used by a lot of non-New York.
What is this story? I don't know this.
All through the year, I get text messages and emails of people saying, or screenshots like, is this you? And it's like, yes, it is me. I am the transphobic person in the training for sexual gender that New York State Human Rights Commission made. I did that gig. And now I have to be the problematic person in the video. And so people who know me or are familiar with me, when they have to take their annual sexual harassment training and gender equity training, they get to see me and they're like, wait, what? So I get those messages all year as well.
Oh my God. Wait, how do they cast this? How do they?
Oh, I had an acquaintance at the time that they were shooting that.
Yeah.
And they were like, we need someone that can be like cis and problematic. And I was like, that's me. Not because I have a reputation for being transphobic. It was like, I was the cis person among a circle of trans folks. And they were like, hey, would you mind being on this thing? You know, they're like, it pays. And I was like, cool, whatever. Cool. I'll do it. I'll help
out. Somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to put it together.
Someone's got to be the problematic cis person.
Yes. Yeah.
You don't have to look too far.
Yeah. One more question on that. What was your specific training module on? What is the lesson?
So it's basically teaching employees like the fact that different people identify different ways, like trans men, trans women, non-binary, gender non-conforming. And it's like, it's a collection of skits. I do know that there were many other people in that thing as well. One of them, I can't recall the name right now. I'm getting old. Some people that are familiar faces in like TV and shows centering queer and trans youth, like Pose. So you would think that I would remember the names right now, and I can't. So sorry. I am perpetually high, as I said in the pre-show. I am going through a little cold or something. As you can hear me sniffle, and so I'm high on NyQuil. So the mind is not all here, but you're going to get a show anyway.
She is a showgirl. The show must go on.
Absolutely.
Yeah. For me, I got a few reactions, and I think some of the people were like, oh, I loved it. What do you mean by all of this? You know? And I think it facilitated a lot of conversations after that movie had shown, and I think there was a lot more discourse. I feel like many months after, right, just from the community alone, talking about, you know, how we want representation to show up, who should be in the movies with us. And I feel like it is a lot of great discourse. And then fast forward, everyone just like forgets about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, now they look back on it and it's just with rose-colored glasses, like, this was great.
Yeah.
Like, okay, whatever. I'm not here to change anybody's mind anymore or fight. You like what you like, and that's that. Cool. Just like with Crazy Rich Asians, I hope that this now kicks the door down for other queer Asian folks, right? Mm-hmm. I'm Asian. I'm crazy. I'm not rich. And I'm not East Asian. But I'm not going to poo-poo on Crazy Rich Asians for being what it was. I instead celebrate what it was and hope that it now opens the door for more possibilities.
Yeah.
Chief among them, a queer Asian film about Fire Island, which, okay, that's our first attempt. Now let's go for something a little more along the lines of what we were saying we wished for.
Yeah. And I think the thing to underscore is that Jonathan and I, when we talk about these things, it's not that we just have so much disdain for it, but I think there are important conversations to be had about it. And a big part of that are conversations that we already have on the side. And whenever we talk, we're just like, oh, we should have made that into a podcast episode. But a lot of the stuff have been stuff that I've ruminated about too personally. And it's a desire of wanting more, right? I feel like for our communities, a desire for wanting more, specifically in this sense, more complexity of different types of queer Asian narratives, definitely a lot more diversity of Asianness, but even the romance and the love aspect to have more complex stories rather than what we see typically.
Right. And speak for yourself, because I do speak with disdain because I see so many people in the community digitally and even in real life talking about how they're tired of XYZ, whether it's representation or being shunned in white spaces. And I'm like, girl, please have some introspection and want more for yourself.
Yes.
Want more for yourself and then call out the fact that like, we could do better. Mm-hmm. So I like, if we're going over here and championing this thing, which is a story, and we're not going to get, you can listen to the other episode that I was in. We talked about this, but I can't imagine fiending for white acceptance in white spaces where they're being mean to me. Mm. Like, you can only do that to me one time. And then I'm just like, okay, whatever. I'm not about to come up with schemes and plans as to why I need to be in this space.
Yeah.
When clearly you don't want me here and that's your loss.
Which is the normalized power dynamic of the like all spaces here in America. I feel like it takes so many people, it's like myself also included, like so long to realize how much effort we had been putting into normalizing versus finally stepping away. And I think, you know, I've been going to talks in the past month and a lot of the talks have been around, well, what do we do? How do we navigate in this space? And all these questions come up time and time again. And I think it points back to a big part of why I personally started a lot of my different organizations, why you started your spaces. It was this realization that sometimes we just have to step away and just make our own thing, create our own spaces, because the spaces in which are saying they champion us, be so inclusive and all that, leave much to be desired.
But it's a tale as old as time.
Yes.
It's like we didn't create these spaces like we were the pioneers or the first ones to do it. There's always been, at least in this United States of America,
Yes.
Somebody who realized like, oh, this is not the mainstream, which is white centric, is not for me. Let me go over here and make this thing. And then they do that thing. And then, you know, you find community and stuff. And then mainstream finds a way to like rip it off and water it down and then make it back into the mainstream. And then go through this weird cycle. It's happened a few times. So,
yeah. And also, just for your upcoming project, I think it's kind of relevant to it where you do talk about these things. You have an upcoming event that you're traveling to, right? Over in Boston.
Yeah, I am going to PAX East. I am a gamer. So last year, I'm going to speak about this very matter-of-factly, and you can Google whatever you need to, because one thing that I'm over is like being in spaces, whether it's queer spaces or corporate spaces, where in corporate spaces, people are talking about the game and like my team and all this. And it's like, nobody's explaining to me who's going to the Super Bowl or who's going to the playoff. Mm-hmm. Everybody just kind of knows it. And then in certain gay spaces, it's like talking about RuPaul's Drag Race and like the queens and this and like not explaining. So I'm just prefacing this by saying, I'm about to talk about a bunch of queer video game shit and I'm not going to stop to explain anything.
We'll put show notes.
I am a fan of the Final Fantasy series, and last year Final Fantasy 16 came out in June. Leading up to the release, IGN, which is a gaming magazine, had an interview with Naoki Yoshida, who is one of the producers of Final Fantasy 16 and the director of Final Fantasy 14, the ongoing MMORPG. And they asked him, given the games, at that time, soon to come out games, setting being in like a medieval Europe, would we be seeing more black and brown people than what we had seen in the trailers and previews so far? And he gave a really weird answer, which was like basically leaning towards saying that black people didn't exist in that setting. And so they wanted to be as realistic as possible. And then the internet was like, well, actually, there were plenty of black people in Europe back then. So I always knew that there was something weird behind it. And then when you actually play the game, it becomes apparent, or at least creates more speculation as to why that is, that he answered that question that way. And so this panel that I'm hosting at PAX East in Boston in March 2024 will be about why that conversation is important, why the question even came up in the first place, where that question came from, and why representation of black and brown skin is still important in Japanese media, such as anime and video games, which, let's be frank, they do it the best in the world. Like, they are awesome storytellers. And very specifically, Square Enix, the company behind Final Fantasy series, has stated that they want to cater to a more global market. So it's a very timely discussion for them. And the tea is that Naoki Yoshida is going to have his own panel at this event on that Friday. And then my panel is on Sunday. So he'll probably already dip out before my panel, but we'll be in the same spaces. And that's going to be very interesting.
Oh, that's going to be great. I think the funniest part was when I was seeing your Twitter feed about this a long time ago, but this whole argument, right? There were no black and brown people in medieval where whenever it takes place. And I think your reaction was like, well, we're like magic, dragons, all these mythical creatures. And it's just something that like, I feel like, especially in this day and age, it's history is also so subjective. And also at the same time, it's just a video game. I feel like there's so many things that we could be so truthful about, right, in this world, but especially when it comes to video game, a fantasy video game, and you also have other players you can play with that are different hybrids of humans and other creatures and elves. And
somehow skin color diversity is the thing that's just like, and it doesn't even need to be in the context of, because this place, this specific place, and then many fantasy settings, they're not actually Europe. Right?
Yeah.
Like, and even if they're based on a European...
If it was even the world, right? If it's even Earth. Yeah.
There are going to be places where, like, even a European place where people came in by boats, there's trade, there's a Silk Road-like thing, mm-hmm. you know, because in ancient Europe, there's the Silk Road that went to Asia. And so brown people came from over there.
Yeah.
And then you're near North Africa. Like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
It's just, it's wild to say that, but the content of the game, specifically Final Fantasy 16, once you get into that story, which I don't know how many of your listeners are gamers, so I'm going to go ahead. And plus the game's a year old at this point. The game ended up being about slavery,
mm-hmm.
right? And so like when I figured that part out, I was like, oh, then you have a whole other thing to deal with as a game developer. And that's mm-hmm. why I don't think that Yoshida and the Square Enix team are so naive. I think they were smart. They just couldn't communicate it in a way that would not have been viewed as quote unquote woke.
Mm.
And that's putting it on the nice side because gaming is not the most progressive space.
Yeah.
And so when you start bringing up things like that, like issues like this about representation and whatnot,
yeah.
or even a developer saying we wanted to do a story about slavery and we didn't want to include black people because we knew that the audience would make memes and run with the joke, right? I'm not saying that that's what he said, but that's what I'm speculating because otherwise, you know, they did their homework. They knew that there were black people in medieval Europe. So what's really going on? And then once you play the game, you're like, oh, now I see. Had they put a bunch of black people in here, this would have been super problematic. And then there's even ways around that, right? So...
Yeah,
I don't want to get too deep into it, but yes, that's what I'm doing at the end of March 2024.
Oh, that's exciting. I mean, it's fantasy. You could replace it with people with like green skin, you know?
And you have green skin people and it's like, and at that point, skin tone doesn't matter, but it does matter because you want people as a brown or black person, you want to be able to see people that look like you, mm-hmm. who you can cosplay accurately without people dragging you on the internet because it's not canonically correct or getting into these arguments. It's like, just put more black and brown people and stuff so that you can squash a lot of these arguments mm-hmm. that certain people love to bring up when they talk about being true to the source material.
Mm-hmm.
And the source material itself, whether we're talking about Narnia or Lord of the Rings or any other fantasy thing, is just so white-centered. Why did they even need to do a story? Or why do so many fantasy stories always have to be based in a European-like setting?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's so tired.
Or it's like, what is so fantastical about these norms that were just deeply ingrained?
And there's nothing wrong with a good old European-like fantasy with its sweeping vistas and mountains of snow and all this. But like, let's get into like the African Serengeti Plains and let's get into the mountains of Asia or like under the sea.
No, if that was the case, then they'll just create a whole separate thing for it. It's Wakanda.
Right.
It's it's the one with what is that one? They're like super
Black Panther.
No, the Asian one, the Seven Rings.
Shang-Chi and the Seven Rings. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hyper specific theme. Like, I mean, I appreciated that. I liked both of those. I liked Black Panther and Shang-Chi and the Legend of the however many rings it was. I said seven, but I'm not sure if that's
how many. Seven rings, eight rings.
I don't know because Ariana Grande also has like a song about a barbecue grill that she had on, right?
She got that too. Hibachi grill, right? It's the barbecue grill.
It's a lot. There's a lot going on in the recent years. So no, I appreciate those attempts. And like when they do that thing again, it's like the first, it's not, maybe not the first one, but it's like one of few. And so what's your critique there? Otherwise, what, you just want these people to exist in a setting that looks like our Western setting and it just happens to have all these black and brown and other non-white people in it?
I think maybe what it is it's putting ethnicities and race as a theme when in fact it's not a separate genre, right? Otherwise, then you'd have a genre called white if you wanted to normalize things, you know? Whereas like genre is really about the type of movie. And I think where we've kind of conflated it is anything that's black and brown, Asian.
It has to be in those other places.
It has to
like
be.
Like we have to shoot on location in Taiwan and South Korea, or like it has to be a made up place in Africa. It just can't be like, well, I guess they tried doing that with like a Disney Plus. When they were overdoing it with Phase 4, the Marvel stuff. Like there was a Black American Captain America story, right?
No, I didn't. I completely lost track of all the superhero movies.
I think like the Falcon guy became Captain America or something. So now he's canonically the new, but I think people got really upset by that. So I don't know what they're going to do.
Is that actual lore or no?
I think I saw like, I'm not the best to keep up with that, but people were like, in the comics, this is what happens. And it's like, is it going to go to the big screen? And now there's multiverses. So you can erase people if you want to, like Jonathan Majors can have an assault case and then be erased, even though he was going to be like the big bad and now they've let him go. So that's what you get for hitting women. You know, don't do that. Don't do that.
Yes, do not.
But what you're saying about like it would be called white, that's very interesting because like outside of the U.S., we're kind of all just viewed as Americans, regardless of how you look.
Yeah.
Right. And that's super interesting to me when we on the inside know like there are hella dynamics going on between someone who looks like me, how I identify as someone who looks like you, right? And both of us identify as Asian of some kind. But at this point, I'm not even down with like lumping all of that together because you and I do not have the same experience, like no shade, no tea. But like we don't. I have people in my family who have similar experiences to yours and we do share some queer experience, but I'm going to be viewed differently. And I understand that. And I actually learned a lot about that. I like ruminated on those thoughts being in Japan recently.
Yeah. Well, before we get to that, I didn't know you had queer people in your family. Did you mention that to me before?
What? Are you joking?
No, I don't think you mentioned this before to me. I don't have any queer people in my family.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it depends on even how you define family, because I can think of plenty of cousins and things like that. Whereas, so I grew up in my mom's side, family was like the immediate family, like mom, dad, grandma, that's it. And that's another, that's a big difference between like Black communities and Asian communities that I've noticed, but not like broad stroking Asian communities, because I know that like multi-generations live in a household and there are Asian families who acknowledge their cousins. But a lot of the Asian people that I knew growing up in the 90s in Southern California, the family was just like the immediate household and cousins were like this idea of like people who live far away for whatever reason.
Well, when their parents immigrated, yeah.
Well, true, yes. Yeah, but also
a lot of them, yeah.
My mom had sisters in the same city and the cousins, we were still not tight like that.
Yeah.
Whereas growing up in the South, moving to the South, everybody on your block was your family, like, and literally your family, not just because we all lived in the same neighborhood, but because we were literally blood related somehow as cousins. So when you ask like, oh, I didn't know that you had queer people in your family. I'm like, what? Like, I know a lot of queer people in my family, but I define family as, you know, all of these extended cousins and stuff. So it's, what's the word? Like inevitable that I'm going to run into another queer person.
I mean, what was it? 30% in a Gen Z study that was done last year, 30% identified as non-heterosexual. So LGBTQ, even IA, I think that counted. They just didn't identify as heterosexual.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So based on that probability, about one third is family. Yeah. So you mentioned you recently went to Japan and you had a lot of revelations coming out of it. One thing is I absolutely love Japan. It is one of my favorite places to go in the world. I used to go every few years. I would hop on by. Sometimes I would have a connecting flight and I would just spend time in the airport in Japan. But this is your first time there. And especially as somebody who's been steeped in a ton of Japanese culture, Japanese video games, what was that experience like? Just like visiting for your first time?
Well, since I am Black and Filipino American, like there's no Japanese in me, like I went over with the expectation and having known like how people act about Japan.
Yeah.
Let's roll it back real quick. My interest in Japan is because of anime, is because of video games. Mm-hmm. But I have seen how other people who idolize Japan and center it in that way act, like the weeaboos. And I'm vehemently against that kind of behavior. So
you don't like a weeaboo?
The first thing that I want to say is that when I went to Japan and everything that I talk about, even since then,
yeah,
I approached it from a standpoint of I am a visitor. I'm staying in an area where probably if you're a normal, everyday, regular Japanese person, you're not going to be living in that area because Japanese people have their own issues with their country. And I'm a tourist on vacation. So I went in with that reality and respect for the people. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I got to meet up with some people that I work with. That was really exciting. Got to go into some really neat buildings and see how they, like just the very small things, like
yeah,
their cafeteria. So I went to the Google building in Roppongi Hills. And then they have one in Shibuya as well, but I didn't go to that one. I had lunch with a colleague and in the cafeteria area, it's like buffet style, just like anywhere else. But they had like 7 rice cookers, like big rice cookers. And I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
In America, we're not going to have just 7 rice cookers, but it's just a normal everyday, like because our houses, this is something that we do share, is like rice all the time. It's going to be there, right? So for the workforce, rice. So it's just little things like that that made me realize like this is a Japanese place run by Japanese people. And then being an American, a Black American, and an Asian American, someone with immigrant parents and then minority parents from the continent, whose ancestors were brought over in chains.
Yeah.
This country, the US, it is our country, but we don't run it. And it's not for us.
Well, the argument is, especially for Black communities who was forcibly brought here, was it ever one's own country when one, it wasn't even your choice to immigrate and forcibly immigrate, and then the other part is never having had rights, you know?
Yeah.
And some people argue it has never actually been anyone's country aside from white folks. Yeah.
But again, I want to acknowledge that maybe through history, Japanese people have also had maybe their own revolution or like...
Yeah, and they were sent to internment camps and then they lost all the properties.
No, not in America. I'm talking about in Japan.
Oh, okay.
Like there's been like all sorts of history there with like struggle of power and then even trying to go beyond Japanese borders to do the rest of Asia, some mistakes there.
There's a lot of mistakes made, yes.
But what I'm saying is like in 2023 when I went as a tourist again, but still it was like this country where... It seemed like you could belong if you wanted to. And as I talk about this more out loud, this is one of the first times I'm processing this. And it's been a few months now. I've been waiting to talk with you about this. Still feeling like we have to do so much extra performative wise to feel like we even, or at least put on the disguise of just fitting in as Americans. But at its very base, the idea of this quote, great American project whether you're Asian American or Black American, mm-hmm. is that, oh, it's a place where a whole bunch of people who had different backgrounds came together and made this new place. Mm-hmm. So technically it is your place. And it's like, that would be all well and good if everybody were fair and equitable about mm-hmm. it. But mm-hmm. we know that the systems in place limit and prohibit that fairness and that equity. Mm. And that a certain group of people are at the center and kept the wealth through history and passed it down and own the buildings mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. and can send their kids to expensive cities and buy them houses so that they can run around Bushwick and do things mm-hmm. without having to worry about paying rent. Mm-hmm. Whilst other people have to struggle.
Their family just owns the building, yeah.
Yeah, so lots of thoughts.
What are you processing? What's like the processing for you?
Just thinking about it, I guess.
Do you feel that here? Like a lot oftentimes?
More now than like I had felt it, but then going to Japan and seeing kind of like this cohesiveness, mm-hmm. kind of like this agreement of we're going to do these things mm-hmm. and whether that's good for them or not, depending on who says what is good and what is not.
Yeah.
So like not intervening a lot, at least stereotypically, not confrontational, but also like not littering.
Yeah.
Right. Like we talked about that in the pre-show. Yes, I did see garbage on the floor. And yes, I did see a guy peeing in the streets in Kabukicho.
You did. I've never seen that.
Like it was like 7 a.m. It was after everything had closed and people were about to go home. But I, of course, with my biological clock, I was up and like walking around. So like these were the Yakuza like winding down.
You and I also don't sleep. Yes. I'll text Jonathan at like 3 a.m. and Jonathan's like, hello.
Well, I was on the other side of the planet and I forgot that people in the US were like not on the same but no, even in Japan, because my biological clock was kind of, I was up at like 4 every morning mm-hmm. and the sun was also up, which was really weird. I just would get up at like 6 and walk around neighborhoods. So I was walking every day. But I saw that. So I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But like, I only saw garbage cans one time on the last day that I was in Tokyo. Mm. And I saw very little trash. Whereas here in New York, trash everywhere.
There's a trash can and there's garbage around it.
And there are garbage cans on every corner. So I'm saying all this to say like, there's like this social contract.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the social contract is based on that idea where if you feel like something's yours, then you're going to treat it better. Mm. Right. And in this case, Japanese people probably feel like this country, this city, this street block is theirs. Mm. And so they want to keep it nice. Whereas here in America, I think there's a lot of like, the city should do it.
Entitlement.
Maybe it's entitlement, but it's also like this lack of, I guess, whatever the opposite of like pride in your neighborhood. Mm. Because it's not your neighborhood. Like, this is owned by somebody else. And I understand what that's implying. And I'm trying. It implies that Japanese people feel like they own their neighborhoods. And not acknowledging whatever. Maybe they have issues with landlords there too as well. But there's something there, right?
Yeah. Especially as Japanese folks in the culture, you're brought up very integrated within a larger community. And even as we talk about like what are the more popular religions, right? Like Buddhism, for example, is really the concept that there's something greater that unites us rather than this like act of having to be a certain way, right? And I feel like in Japanese culture, there's a bigger sense, like you mentioned, of community, of society. And I think I've struggled to articulate this about America, where it's like most people will be like, well, it's about like me first and then it's me second in like Japan or these other countries, right? But what I think another way that I've started to articulate it is really, I like your take of, well, is this truly mine, this space and these people around me, right? My relatives, my family, friends, my community, or is it like something that I'm just like, this is me against the world? And there's something interesting to be said about that, because most of the people who run the country here in America, in corporations and all these places, Like, this was never their ancestral homeland, you know?
Right.
And so I think there's something to be said about that being the underpinning of this country, led into the culture that we have now, where there is no respect for nature, the land, and all this stuff, because it was never a part of the practice to begin with. But we are very good at taking space, colonizing different territories, right? We're definitely really good at claiming, staking ground, property. And maybe that's it, where I feel that in certain countries, in Asia, in Africa, where there's been thousands of years of heritage passed down, there's maybe that too, where it's not just this is my land and my space, but this is of my ancestors and people before them. And so if I'm not taking care of this space, it's not I'm just disrespecting me and my immediate family, but generations of people before me.
And that's a very interesting point too, because I went to a lot of shrines and temples.
Mm-hmm.
And a thing that ran through my mind as I was reading about, like reading the plaques,
mm-hmm.
and the information, it's like, or like Googling it, because I like to research where I'm going. These places are older than our country or the United States of America.
Yeah.
There are bars in Europe and toilets in Asia that are older than the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wild to me.
Yeah. Some sacred grounds. Yeah.
And there was an energy there that was just like so old. And so I think that, what you said about like the underpinnings or of the foundations of the country, not only is it everything that you said about not respecting nature and expansion and individualism, or rather, I wanted to add that part of individualism. Very me, capitalistic. And all these, there are other capitalistic nations in Asia for sure. But that lack of community, and it's hard to make community with people when they don't like you. And like when they very much like hate you just based on how you look, when we're allegedly all Americans, we're all supposed to be in the same camp.
Mm-hmm.
Yet as Americans, you treat different groups different ways. One group that you brought over in chains forcibly, you have consistently destroyed their neighborhoods and their communities that they've tried to build up to try to make a dollar, and stolen land from another group of people. And then you bring in other people as cheap labor.
Yeah.
It's just like...
Well, you know the history of Central Park, right? Where Central Park, before the park was there, it was a whole enclave.
I feel like I'm the one who told you this.
Were you?
I feel like I was, but please, for your listeners, go ahead.
No, you tell us. You know, you tell us.
Just Google Seneca Village. That's what...
Well, that's what I was mentioning with the stolen. It's not just like stolen from the native folks, but just years and years, even beyond, stealing from different communities. I feel
what
like...
What you're saying is that after it was stolen from the native folks... Then they stole from people that were Americans, yes.
Yeah. Or then they did the same thing to Japanese folks all around the United States, especially in California, where they had homes, they had businesses, and they were like, hey, it's very patriotic to like leave and be over here while we figure out this war situation. And then all of their business and homes.
And then they didn't get their stuff
they
back.
They did not get it back. And then there was a whole enclave of folks who were deported from America, who were born in America, and were sent to Japan with no citizenship. And there were these whole group of people who had no citizenship anywhere in the world whatsoever.
So, you know, I feel like I don't want us to get too History Channel on your listeners.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's important to talk about all of this to understand why we criticize things like Fire Island.
Yeah.
So now let's thread the connection. Like, we're talking about how all the reasons why one might not feel included in the US and why representation matters, why I'm doing this panel.
Yeah.
As compared to other places where it's not necessarily homogeneous because there are different ethnicities all throughout Asia and different specific Asian nations like Japan and China. There are different kinds of people and there are different minorities and they have their different issues. But this great American project where they say that, oh, well, you're all Americans, so you should all be happy as Americans and have all the same opportunities. Do we have the same opportunities? Is everyone getting equal time in the spotlight?
Yeah.
In TV and movies? Or is the reality that everything that we present in media, in other venues, always from a particular lens, i.e. the white lens?
Or are we building with inclusion in the future? Because speaking of something recent, I just recently read a report where people were testing the recent build of ChatGPT, and they realized that a lot of the biases that we had talked about, biases just as a society, right? Early on in hiring practices, were names, for example, were screened out, particularly the ones that didn't sound as American, as white, right? And so they ran this test where they had different resumes set up, and they ran it through ChatGPT recently. And ChatGPT was ordered to rank them across different industries and different roles of who would rank the highest. And what do you have? ChatGPT reinstitutionalizing the same exact biases that we had reported when it was humans running it too. And so I think the other point I'm adding too on top of yours is this is so important because the future that we're building, we have to figure out what the F we're going to do, because right now things are crumbling, things are falling apart. I feel like things are even worse than before in a way, but also everyone's in just not the best place. And meanwhile, we have so much, and this has been a big narrative for myself, but over the past like year and a half, I haven't been on social media as much. I've just completely exited it. I'm just seeing just all the stuff that was being circulated, in the sense of like, I was like, but where are we going with all of this? You know? And I've mentioned on a previous podcast, but why I truly value you, Jonathan, especially as a friend and fellow collaborator, is you're one to also create spaces and actually make the change and creating the things that we need. And I feel like we've sometimes been caught up with all of this. On the flip side, right? Talking about is important, but on the flip side, sometimes we get so stuck in this space where we're just talking and talking and droning each other out, but sometimes forgetting, like, in reality, like, we're here. We have to figure out what to do with each other,
right?
Whether we like it or not. It's like siblings, you know, like angry siblings who've been fighting for so long, and your parents are just like, figure it out.
But it's also okay to tap out.
Mm-hmm.
It is very much okay. I actually tried to get back into a particular, not circle, but like planning for an organization that I had lent my energy to about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at the first meeting, I was like, oh, I remember why I left this the first time. This would be an example of doing the work, quote unquote. And it would be for a great, it's organizing for a great cause that comes up every summer. But I'm not working with these particular people. It wasn't just one particular kind of people. It was, I'm tired of having to go through the rigmarole of dancing around this, but then this weird logic, just very weird logic around a lot of things. I'm being intentionally vague because I don't want to out this organization for anything problematic that may or may not have happened. Problematic stuff happened, and that's why I dipped out on the call. But like, just seeing that people talk the talk since 2020 about being diverse and inclusive, and with everything going on in the world today, and you're planning for a huge event that millions of people come to New York City for in the summertime from around the world. And there's just so much cognitive dissonance around what you say you know and what you say we need to champion, and then actually putting that into practice when it comes down to planning stuff. And I got into that space of trying to organize with people. And I was like, you know what? You all do what you're going to do. You don't need me because I'm not about to have these same arguments. And that's me specific, you know, and if anybody else wants to do that kind of, and get their hands dirty in that kind of work and have to have those tough conversations and make people feel uncomfortable because you're calling them out on how they're being hypocritical on certain issues, then fine. You expend that work and expend that energy.
Yeah.
If you have it to give. Sometimes it's good to tap out and recognize that you don't have that energy to give.
What has been a lesson or learning since we last talked in a year of continuing to be a part of this work, doing social activism digitally, physically, the lesson that's come up for you that you've learned?
So I'm glad that you asked that, because the last time that we talked, we had planned to talk about a certain thing, not specific, but a dynamic within that organizing that we didn't get to. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that I've learned since then and that I've clocked. And the story I just laid out is me putting action into being aware of this. And this is the weaponization of marginalization. Mm-hmm. It is people trying to use one issue or one intersection to kind of one-up you. Mm-hmm. And it's like, girl, we're both marginalized people. Just because you're more marginalized than me doesn't mean that. And ironically, we both share the other thing that you're not. Mm-hmm. So it's not like just mm-hmm. because you're this one thing, suddenly you are more valid than anything that I have to say. Mm-hmm. But people will use these different intersections to claim that they are more oppressed. And we're not saying that you're not more oppressed, but that oppression doesn't give you more validity in a non-related situation.
Yeah.
Where we're talking about some complete other thing like planning. I'm being very vague because, again, I'm not trying to out anybody more.
Understood. Maybe more will come out. What resonates with me from that is, and I've talked about this with previous episodes, and also a lesson for me in the coming year was, and why it was really hard in social media, is I don't think social media does a really good job of holding multiple truths the same time, right? Multiple conflicts at the same time. And what you're talking about, this aspect of marginalization, and then even like the concept of intersectionality and the concept of identities, have facing certain marginalization, and the intersection of that is also very uniquely different. I feel like a big part of this also points to the fact that we're all shouting in this echo chamber that only allows one thing to pop out at once. You know, it's like this conveyor belt at the front. It's like this, everyone's throwing all these little bits and problems, right? And then we're waiting for almost like this algorithm to like cherry pick, okay, this problem is the most important. It's resonating the most. Boop, and then it goes down the conveyor belt. And then it pops up in our feed. And I think that's been also very top of mind for me, of why I've also not been as active on social media, is even looking at conflicts happening all around the world. I think there's so many things that are still happening. And I think the struggle is, how do we give voice to all of them in an equal way? I also reflect on, I have some folks working over at Planned Parenthood, right? And they're being asked to stand up for certain causes and issues, and the folks are still dealing with the issues of the overturn of Roe v. Wade still, you know? And especially with the work that you do, that I do, that we all do in community already, I think there's this thing that's really important to underscore, is especially when our community members start weaponizing us for not having done more work for certain things, but then we're already working to help different communities, to help different facets of it. I think it's so hard to, right, to your point, start pitting, well, one is more important than the other. But the realization is we all are struggling very, very intensely across different, not even a singular spectrum, right? A variety of different markers. And I think where I'm starting to see many communities, especially that are very heavily in social media, are headed towards is this loss of empathy for that, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
It's this theory that it's not empathy that we're after, but it's what is creating the most anger, the most turmoil, the most pain of that moment. And then to your point, right, weaponizing the marginalization of that to then say to everything else, well, be quiet. You're not as important right now.
Yeah. And let's get to the heart of it. I said I was being intentionally vague, but through the years, especially working at the intersection of Blackness and Asianness, being a Blasian myself and many other Blasians in the same boat with me, and whether they know me, and I'm talking about instances where we've actually been together in digital spaces trying to navigate this, or if you're just a regular ass Blasian somewhere else that does this on your own on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Like the whole since 2020 thing where it was like Asian people saying like, stop Asian hate, transactional allyship with Black people, or I'm going both ways with this, Black people dismissing Asian attacks and the fear that Asian people have because Black people have the history they do in this country. Not invalidating either side, but a lot of people, like personally I'm not, but a lot of people will do that across the aisle. And
a tip for tat.
If you call it out like someone like me, then, oh, you're being a traitor to this side, or, oh, you only care about Black people, or, oh, you're riding with the Asians and not.
Well, wait, before you continue, one, the plus one to that is it's the othering that they're doing to you, right? Where it's like, you were never, I didn't truly consider you as a part of my community to begin with. So it's almost like finding a reason to validate why they're allowed to other you as a part of it.
And I mean, you could apply, you could take that same thing that I just laid out and apply any identities. And it, especially if you do exist as a person at the cross of those two identities, it's even more difficult. But it's because social media is the way it is. And I commend you for getting off of it and saving your sanity and recognizing and clocking these dynamics. And yeah, there's real people behind these profiles in a lot of this work we do. There's also a lot of trauma and a lot of stuff that we don't have to sift through to keep our own sanity. And when it's something easy like Twitter or X or Facebook, where all you're doing is typing and dumping on somebody and you're not seeing the person, then it's just easier to be, whether intentional or not, less apt to receiving communicating effectively.
And my big lesson that I've been really taking part in has been, well, where are you trying to go with this? Right? It's like with all this that is being put on social media, being perpetuated, all this stuff, like what's the end? So what's the end goal, right? And oftentimes it's a very hard answer to give because it really takes into account where we're at and what are we really thinking, you know? And I think there's something that I haven't really talked about that I'm going to share on this podcast that I think is also really important that's very similar to our discussion now is also this concept of abolition, right? And I feel like in social justice and many different discussions, there is this concept of abolition. It's a very trendy word as of the past few years, right? And it's a very hard topic because true abolitionists, right, is this notion of abolishing certain institutions as a part of policing, as a part of creating order through, you know, a very biased judgment. But I find that there is this very tricky line that people toe, right? When it comes towards like holding quote unquote accountability, right? And all of a sudden it's like you stand for the abolition of police state, but then the instant like you face any personal persecution or anything that's happened in your garden,
you're calling the cops.
All the cops, you're calling 911 and you're like, get them, you know? And it's this rhetoric that, you know, just seeing it from the sidelines that I've been observing of all these people who, you know, will claim certain terminologies and words. And as soon as anything happens in their garden, in their space, that they are pro-police and pro-
Because they're clout chasers.
Judgment.
Because they're clout chasing.
Yeah.
Because it's too hard to be real about the fact of the matter. And it's that the popular thing for a lot of people during the, since 2020 is what defund the police or abolish the police. And then you had conversation around that because defund doesn't mean abolish. And people who are abolitionists would let you know that very quickly.
Yeah.
And then there are people who are like, oh, well then, okay. I mean, abolish the police. When really what they really felt was defund the police because they are overfunded and give that money to certain other places like mental health. Yeah. But I still want police because if someone mugs me, then I want to be able to call the police. Mm-hmm. But you can't stand 10 toes down on that view because you're afraid that other people, abolitionists or whoever, or the people who are also bandwagoning are going to call you out.
Yeah.
Like, no, stand 10 toes down in it. If you want the police to still be around, then that's you. That's your opinion. Yeah. And if you want to defund them because you feel like they have too much money, but you still want them to be around, that's you. Or if you're the type of person that just thinks there should be no police at all, stand 10 toes down in it so that we can have the conversation instead of bandwagoning, because that bandwagoning leads to groupthink and just, you can tell I can get very passionate about this, but both of us have sat on the sidelines and watched people jump onto bandwagons just so that they don't have to think for themselves, mm-hmm. so that they can avoid getting dragged.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, don't allow people to drag you. Just mm-hmm. tell people why this is how you feel and then we can work on it. And then at the end of the day, it's the internet. We can agree to disagree.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's the internet.
It is. And I think you and I think over the years, we've developed a lot of empathy in doing this work. This work is not easy. Like creating organizations, creating space, creating moderators, Jonathan, I know you're always on calls with your teams to figure out how you're addressing certain issues that are posted.
I'm not even going to front like we still do that stuff. But back in the day, it was really required.
Back in the day, you were putting in the time. It was a job and it was unpaid.
For everyone, not just me, mm-hmm. but for everyone.
It was unpaid. And that is, it takes a lot of work. And I think, especially for so many folks, and this is why I also really struggle with social media, is so many folks who claim, and I think this is where I get really, I have a lot of difficulties with, especially with a lot of the mainstream influencers, right? Who will hop on a lot of these really trendy things. And at the end of the day, especially as, you know, someone like yourself and someone like myself, we start our own organizations and businesses. And if these influencers honestly, truly cared, the tea is, if they truly cared, why don't they start these organizations, right? To go like champion these causes and these...
Too much work.
Exactly. That's too much work. Exactly. They could easily start.
I just want to get a check for mm-hmm. posting my black square. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. come on. And now we're getting back into performative allyship and performative activism mm-hmm. and performative.
It never left. It never left social
never
media.
Never left. And people put the mm-hmm. book back on the shelf a long time ago. And we clocked it. I clocked it for sure. And I'll forever, I think I've said it on this podcast twice. And I said it on every time I get on this, every time I get on a platform, I make this example. Gushers and fruit by the foot said Black Lives Matter. Yes, what the hell? Yes.
But you know, I think that was our very first podcast episode we did.
And you know what? Another one. Here's another one. So where we talked about that. Here's another one. No, I'm not going to call them out. I do like the space. But a space for Gaysians, a very big space for Gaysians on the internet, had stickied on the main, like on the front page, mm-hmm. a thread about Black Lives Matter and why. And they had like 400 likes. And then this year, I think I sent you screenshots about this.
Yeah.
Someone went on a rant about why everybody has to tiptoe around Black people. And if I like white men, then I'm just going to I should just be allowed to do that. And why do Black people always have to be at the center? Oh, it was because that video. There was a video that went around recently here.
It was on Reddit.
I wasn't trying to out any community. Oh. But there was a video that was shared on Reddit from TikTok. And I forgot. It was a guy. It was an East Asian guy, and he was talking about basically not fitting into white spaces.
Yeah.
That for January 2024, whoever that was, it happens all the time. But someone posted it, and then it got to Twitter.
Yeah.
And then a lot of Black people responded, well, you know, this is how Asian people treat Black people. Mm-hmm. And so then in the Reddit, an Asian person, a Filipino person, mm-hmm. was like, why is it that Asians' feelings never get heard, or like we silencing Asians. And then they were like, This video was about an Asian person talking about not fitting into white spaces. Why did Black people have to take over the conversation? Why is it always about them? And I went off. I was like, you are so embarrassing. We are both Filipino. This is so embarrassing that you are throwing Black people under the bus because you want to be included in white spaces like this person. Everybody, like, he's like, oh, most of the quote retweets were about Black people and getting the most likes. I was like, because it's true. Mm-hmm. For everything that that guy was saying in that video, the Gaysian was saying, the East Asian Gaysian was saying about not, going back to Fire Island. Yes, y'all get treated shitty by white people. Mm-hmm. And you treat Black people shitty. Like, oh, I can't find a date. Well, maybe you should broaden your horizons because plenty of people do want to date you. Maybe not just shitty ass white people. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if we can talk like that on here, but like, they are not.
You can. They're not go for it, yeah.
Go for the people who go for you. Whether they're Asian or Black or white, like, just don't limit it to one thing. But, oh, God, that's another topic that, you know, I can go on forever about. But how did we even get here? It's that performativeness.
It's because
they allowed all that to that conversation to happen. Whether they're maybe they're not on watch anymore, like maybe the mods are not watching anymore. But like, but then for years, like 3 years, had Black Lives Matter stickied at the top of a Gaysian space. Like, stop it.
Well, it just goes back to these spaces, right? Like, you rarely know the full context of what's happening with the space, and you rarely have the full story. And I think 9 times out of 10, what you're trying to piece together are just from little fragments on social media, right? And so people will do just a lot of this virtue signaling, right? Of these little things, putting it in the ground. Have they really done the work? Not really. Oh, my last point with this is that the work is hard. This work is really hard. And I think we should define people more by the work they're doing rather than by who they say they are. And I think in all of these social media platforms, at least that's the biggest lesson that I've learned, is I'm trying to listen more by actions, not by words. And those who depend solely on words to let you know who they are, I think there's so much that's just lost in that. And those who are speaking more by actions they're taking, things that they're doing, I think it helps to show a little bit more of the actual work that's happening.
Yep.
Yes.
I agree. Also that people who are doing the work should not be pressured. Like, you have to keep... You have to have a website or you have to have something to show for your work, but don't feel like you just have to do something. Like, if you want to tap out, like, that's my thing. If you want to tap out, you can do that. I have tapped out. Mm. I did a lot of stuff. We've got a website to show that does say who we are and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But at this point, I'm here for the memes and the laughs. Like, at this point, especially in Black Asian Alliance Network, it's more of like finding things that make us and things that we relate to. The most recent post that was really popping was a simple question: Uncle Phil or Uncle Iroh? Like, those are two very, like, one's very Black and one's very Asian. You know, Uncle Phil from Fresh Prince, then Uncle Iroh from Avatar the Last Airbender. That generated a lot of conversation, and it got pretty deep, actually. So people were like, well, Uncle Phil never did war crimes. And someone else was like, well, Uncle Iroh wasn't a judge in mid-90s Southern California under the Clinton administration.
Like, what? Wait, I didn't know he was a... Was he really a judge?
Yeah, Uncle Phil was a judge. Wasn't he? I feel like he was. In the new one on Peacock, he's not
a judge. I had no idea. I had no idea what he did. He would just come in much later in each episode and saunter in.
Yeah, Uncle Phil, I think he was a judge in the original Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
I had no idea.
So there was a lot of deep conversation around that. But like, as opposed to like the early days when we're fighting day in and day out and trying to heal because of things, I feel like maybe at least from the media perspective, a lot of things have simmered down. But again, you have to wonder why the media was pushing all that stuff at that time, because the stuff is still going on. Like, Asians still get attacked It's just, it's not getting foisted upon us every single day. And so now we're not in the Black and Asian space arguing with each other every single day about it.
Well, I think a lot of Asian channels have been either shut down or the founders have gotten really tired of just continuing to post about the violence. And I think the same with many other different minority-based spaces. I think people are just getting tired of posting about violence and stuff like that. And also at the same time...
Ooh, I don't know about that, Stephen. I feel like some people made it more...
I say this broadly as I'm noticing less...
But we'll acknowledge that there were some spaces that their whole dedication was to making the other side look bad.
That's it. No, they still do. Some spaces still do. That's it. That's their whole channel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they blocked me, so...
Me too. I'm not going to be shady because I don't play with things like death, but...
No. Yeah, we've both been blocked. What is an advice who are also listeners to our podcast are activists and people who are doing the work? And I guess I'm wondering, do you have any advice for them? I think, you know, tapping out as needed is really good, but I'm curious, do you have any other thoughts for people who are navigating the space, navigating this time?
Well, if someone is an activist and they're listening to this, then I am not the one that needs to give them advice. They are the ones leading the charge. Maybe I had my activist hat on back in whatever day, but like, I don't know, like even the biography, it's like, yes, I have been bringing attention to certain things and intersections since 2008. Does that make me an activist? Does that make me someone that activists should look up to?
You're so humble. Yeah.
I don't know. So here's what I will say as someone who has been doing certain kinds of work in bringing awareness.
Yeah.
I guess activating awareness. So I guess I am an activist. As someone who is tapped out right now and will eventually get back into it, like with this coming panel, I'm still doing things.
Yeah.
So as like, maybe we should frame this around like new activists or like, because I would never dare try to advise someone older than me or someone who's been doing it longer. But for you newer activists out here, if you don't stand for something, you will fall for anything. Mm-hmm. Stand 10 toes down in whatever it is that you believe. Mm-hmm. And then all of you activists and all of you people that are doing all of these causes, we need a social contract that says that we're going to become more nuanced. We're going to use the vocabulary that we throw around in terms of intersectionality and understanding and inclusion. And we're going to act like the internet is not just a place where you can say whatever you want and then dip out and like get mad or drag someone or cancel them because you don't agree with it. Like that has to stop. We have to be able to talk to each other and we need to be able to agree to disagree if that's what it comes to, because the other person, no matter how much you hate what they say, are going to exist anyway.
Yeah.
So if you need to get there to where you need to like be like, okay, I'm now I understand what you're about, then you need to do the work. You actually need to do the work to get there before you label someone as a thing.
Yeah.
I think is where my head is right now, because I saw this play. It was called The Ally. And it's very timely right now. It's at the Public Theater in New York City.
Ooh, I haven't heard of it. What's it about?
It is about a college professor who signs a petition and then he thinks it's going to be harmless, but then it blossoms into this big thing about college campuses. It talks about like ideas around college campuses, at least in recent years, how like they'll shut down a speaker from coming because they don't agree. And it's like, you could invite the KKK to your college. I'm not going to be out there saying that they're not allowed to speak, because they're going to speak somewhere. I don't have to go to it, and I can encourage others not to go to it, but I can't force someone to be like, no, you shouldn't have them as a speaker.
Yeah.
At least that's, and maybe you know what? But now that I've put that out there, so the people who would cancel me or drag me, I want to know why. Because the people are going to exist anyway. They're already going to be there anyway. Are you saying that a university would amplify their voice? I hope that people are not like the people that we're talking about. I hope that society can get back to being not bandwagoning people that can hear grotesque and awful things and be like, that's grotesque and awful. Let me not align myself with that.
And move on. Yeah. I mean, that goes to, so responding to your advice, I think you laid down some good things, but just working backwards, right? I think it goes back to, are you building up your community or you focus on the people who you don't want to be like? And oftentimes in doing the work, right, we can get so hyper fixated on these people that you're like, this is the enemy or these are the bad people. And let's say you have 10 hours to dedicate to something and all 10 hours went to that. Your community is still suffering. Your community is still struggling. What have you done, right, to uplift the community? And people will be like, well, no, like these people, da, da, da. And
but that flamboyance and that kind of rhetoric and that kind of flashiness and that kind of calling other people out is what eats up the airwaves and yes. gets the shine.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you could have been over here collecting phone numbers and connecting people to mutual aid.
Yes.
And sitting over there and eating your cereal.
Making space, having discussions, creating safe spaces.
Instead of fighting people on the internet. Like,
yeah. And then stepping away. And I like your point about standing for something, because I feel that a lot of social media is all about poking at people's egos, and people who are so compelled to have to post is because you felt like maybe your ego was challenged, right? Or you were made to feel unsure about yourself, and you respond and you react and say, oh, I have to follow this, I have to post this. But it's because we haven't done the work to fortify, what do we stand for? Who are we? What is the work that we do, right? And let's say if we are for a certain community and we're already doing this work, then I don't need to have somebody messaging, well, are you not doing this? Well, if they're not another organizer or somebody doing the work, exactly. I'm like,
I wish someone would come to me and be like, well, you haven't talked about, well, then why don't you talk about it? We both have, someone will DM me on Instagram and be like, well, why haven't you spoken about it? Well, let me check your profile real quick.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a large following and you could build one.
Yeah. Why haven't you built one and why aren't you doing it? Yeah.
That's very interesting, because another person, I won't name them, but they have recently been, so it's someone that I know and they know me.
Mm-hmm.
But, they were saying some really weird stuff online.
Mm-hmm.
They took a stance where I was like, and I didn't just outright like be like, but I am taking a break from them. But basically, long story short, I mean, if I, you wouldn't know who to look up. So I'm just going to
keep it generic. Yeah.
Keep it generic, but it's a very specific like thing.
Okay.
So because of the Israel-Palestine conflict, mm-hmm. a particular actor has gone on a med strike. He's HIV positive.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the theater that he works for has not released a statement in support of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And until they do, he's going to stop taking his meds. So that's his form of protest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a playwright who is very popular in the space, like not the theater space, like that particular theater, but like in theater in general,
mm-hmm.
who's been very outspoken about critiques on wokeness and also standing at the intersection of like blackness and queerness, has criticized this actor's protests because they have personal ties with people who have passed away from HIV/AIDS. And so I think, and that's the person I know, is the person that's mad at the actor. And so he was posting a lot. And I was like, why is he so like, why is he going so hard on this? Like, what is it? Like, I can see that there's some trauma there because he did lose a friend. He wrote a play that won a Pulitzer Prize. I can see the trauma there. Why does this matter to you how this other person is protesting? But at the end of the day, to keep it 100 and concise, basically what I figured was that the person I know is mad that someone else is leveraging their disability or their status to pressure an organization to make a statement, a political statement on a thing.
Yeah.
That's his form of protest.
Mm.
That's his health that he is putting on the line.
Mm.
Right. And if that's how he feels like.
And also it's up to the theater to decide whatever they want. And it's also up to.
And it's up to the theater to decide what they want to do or not. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm just like sitting over here like, but why are you mad at the person that's protesting? Like you're mad because they're trying to hijack the theater, like pressure.
And this has nothing to do with them either. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know there's a connection there because of the way that the protest is happening, but you are not HIV positive yourself. You told me as such. And
Well, there's no, like, you're not personally affected by this either.
Well, I think the personal affection is maybe because, again, going back, he has had critiques on wokeness, quote unquote. He's more concerned about the fact that someone's leveraging something, an oppression, to make someone say something. I forgot why I brought that up, but I feel like that right there, what I just said, is the reason I brought it up. That was the end goal, was that, I guess it's, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything, right?
Yes. Yeah. And you have to stand for something to be unshakable, right? At the end of the day, everyone can do anything. The reality is on social media, everything everyone is doing, who knows what the purpose is for either. We're never going to know. They're never going to tell us.
But you can tell.
you can sometimes tell.
Some of us who have been here can tell when you're a bandwagoner and you're a charlatan.
Yeah. Sometimes it's really easy to tell. You're right.
Because where are some of those voices that were so loud in 2020 now?
Yeah.
And why were a lot of them actors?
And then after they got their roles.
Right. Then all of a sudden that stuff went away. But you were all over the country talking about this and that. You were on ABC News and doing all of this.
As soon as they got a few Marvel movies.
People that jumped into the activist space were actors that couldn't work in Broadway or wherever. And that's shame. But yes, it's the truth.
Yeah,
especially here in New York. Let's call a thing a thing. That's a viral clip right there for your podcast. Let's talk about it. A lot of the activists in 2020 were actors. And not just saying that figuratively, but literally, were literal actors who worked in the acting scene and couldn't find work, so they jumped into activism. I had to cross my leg on that one.
No, it's so true. But you know what? We let the evidence speak for itself.
The cream rises to the top. Thing will be called a thing.
The thing will be called a thing. But, you know, it goes back to, right? If it really, truly mattered, it will manifest itself in something, some shape, form, or way, right?
Maybe they influenced somebody, right?
But there's so many people, and I love seeing people starting different organizations and different projects. And there's something to be said about how it was so moving to individuals to a point where they had to institutionalize it, and that's going to stick around. And that's where I want to put more of my time, my energy. Been doing a lot more collaborative work here in the city. And I think my advice, my like plus 3, 4, 5 to you is just finding people who are also doing work that you resonate with, right? And then working together with them. And then it's like our friendship. I always appreciate having you on. I'm always here to support any of your stuff. And I think that's how we get through these things, you know? And at the end of the day, human connection with one another is so important. And if we can't even sell that as a part of doing this work, I think it might be important to ask, like, what are you digging your heels into the ground for? Like, what is the reason, you know?
Do something. Like, just do something. And it doesn't even have to be in the lane of activism.
But don't just post. No, don't post.
Right. I mean, that doesn't help in either way, whether it's activism or not. Like, we need to get back to doing things outside.
Yes. Yeah.
We need to go back outside.
Yeah.
And for some of you listeners out there, you live in more rural areas. And so that's not so easy. It's not easy to make new friends. But to those of you.
But it's important. Rural areas also deserve spaces like this. Mm-hmm.
They do. And so if you can find people that will drive over from another county and meet at a regular, larger place, then do that. Because I went back to Mississippi last week and I had a rental car and I was like, you know what? If I lived here, I would have to drive 20 miles. But that's not that bad. Like here in New York, you wait an hour to get 2 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And out there, it's just like, okay, 20-minute drive and you're in the next city.
Yeah.
Organize something. And again, it doesn't have to be activism. Start up a D&D campaign or have a poker night. Do something. Get with the people and talk about this stuff. And then for those of us in New York City or any other large city like Steve, we need to do better about getting together and doing stuff. And it doesn't have to always, if you're tapped out, I am also tapped out. We can just enjoy a thing.
Yeah.
So as for where we go from here, I actually am starting, one of the things that I want to do, first of all, 2024 has been going really well for me.
Yeah.
And it's from a glass half full okay. perspective, because some bad things in terms of like things not panning out the way that I wanted them mm-hmm. to have happened in these 3 months so far.
Yeah.
But I'm counting my blessings and the good things. So I got that PAX East panel approved.
Which is a big deal.
It is a big deal. Now I'm also trying to make the New York City video game course, which awesome. That fell through. I dumped like $400 into hiring an accompanist, running ads, and but it's a learning experience. Like a lot of people signed up, but then when you email them to confirm that they can come on the day that you said it was going to be when they signed up, all of a sudden people are radio silent. I'm like, okay, I figured it out. Because I had a respectable number for something as niche as a video game choir. Like 26 people said that they wanted to come, and then only five were able to commit to the time. And I'm like,
wait, how many do you need? Can't you do it with five? Do like an a cappella group.
I ordered an accompanist and everything. So like,
yeah,
I paid for the venue, which was like $200, and it was empty. I like canceled the night before. I'm not about to show up and looking stupid like some of these TikTok creators at these events where they have a million fans and then nobody comes to their booth.
Yeah.
It's a lesson learned, but it's an attempt. And not everybody has $500 to drop on a thing, but do something.
Yeah.
Get together with people.
Doesn't have to cost money. It doesn't have to cost money. Mm-mm.
But if you've got it and you're willing to invest or try to do something, like,
yeah,
let's try to do things in real life, I guess. Yes.
And it doesn't have to be what's trendy.
Right.
It can be creating space for each other, for other folks with similar experiences as you.
Third spaces are very much needed.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, some quick questions. What's inspiring you lately?
Lately, what's inspiring me? There is this film that I watched on the way back from Japan on the plane. It's by, the director's last name is Kore Eda. And it's called Monster, and it's on Apple TV now. It was not available for streaming when I saw it on the plane, and I started it like an hour before we landed. It's like a 15-hour flight, and I started it before we landed, so I didn't finish it.
Yeah.
And then it came out in like November of that year, and like I saw it six times in theaters. It's that good. So this kind of, if you see the movie, then you'll understand why I had to watch it so many times, because it's one of these things that unfolds. And so what's inspiring me is this particular movie and this director and how he does a lot of his films and the whole Rashomon style of storytelling.
Yeah.
Well, that's inspiring me. And that's what's making me think like I need to be more creative this year.
Oh, I love it. I know you dropped a few lessons, but is there any one last lesson, or what is your lesson and last takeaway for today's session?
Oh gosh, you're right. I have said so much, but yeah, I'm going to go back to stand for something.
I think that's a good one.
Again, stand for something or you'll fall for anything. And at this point, my mindset is you still have to wear a mask if you're sick, and I'm high on NyQuil. So I've been wearing a mask when I go out, and I'm about to go out now. But it's not like it was in 2020, 2021, 2022. I'm not going to say we're out of the pandemic yet. COVID is going to be a thing that we live with for a very long time. But now we can come out of our shells. And it's going to take some people longer, but try to find activities to undo whatever that was and whatever society had started doing in 2020 and beyond. I'm not saying that the accountability culture was a bad thing. I'm saying the flippantness, the quick to cut off the...
And especially for our own community members, I think it's a very different narrative.
Especially for our own, wherever you are.
How can people find you? / do you have any recent projects you want to highlight?
Well, on social media, I am Jonah San on all the platforms, J-O-N-A-H-S-A-H. So Instagram, TikTok, and the project is what I mentioned. The video game course is something that I really want to make happen. So much to the point that I recorded a video and made and poured like $200 worth of ads into it, and a lot of people saw it.
Yeah,
like people saw it and they were interested, but when it came to time to commit, they were not. So we'll revisit that after the panel. We're gonna try to ramp it up through the summer. I'm going to do a lot of studying on how to
Yeah.
get people I've been going to other choir things. I've joined a choir, actually. You know, I had a lot of trauma around that in the early 2020s, but I've joined a new choir and it's awesome. And then there are other choir things that happen around the city that are much less commitment time oriented. And I've also done those. So getting back into going outside, basically.
Nice. Yeah.
Oh, and starting a new podcast, The Boys Are Black in Town with Loki Karuna. It's a video podcast and it's on my YouTube page, which is Jonah San as well.
Nice.
If it gets, if we start doing more and it gets bigger, then we'll cut out its own space for it. But for now, it's just on my YouTube platform.
Nice, nice, nice.
And it's called The Boys Are Black in Town because I am Black and Asian. I also bring a lot of Asian perspective to that. What's interesting to me there, and I should, we should have talked about this way earlier, but it's funny how like I'm comfortable in doing a whole podcast about being Black, but I am Black and Asian, but I don't, I'm not comfortable doing any kind of podcast that would be like Asian this, just Asian this.
Maybe that's something to explore.
Maybe it's something to lean into, but I will appear on podcasts like this that are about an Asian community, and I am comfortable in my Asianness that way because you are hosting.
Yeah.
What does that say? I don't know, actually.
Maybe 2025 revelation.
Maybe I just... just claim my Asianness, and if anybody has anything to say about
this is,
it.
This is the episode when Jonathan...
This is the moment of realizing I own space in the Asian realm as well. And so it'll be funny. It's like people will listen. They'll be like, oh, he's Asian. They'll see a picture. He's not Asian. Or at least that's what I would think they would say. But
yeah. And then for those of you listening... definitely leave us a rating review if you enjoyed this episode with Jonathan. This is how our friends, our folks, our community discover and listen to our episodes. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And also, if you have a moment, feel free to visit our website at yellowgodopodcast.com to learn more about our episode, views, show notes, transcriptions, and all that jazz. And we'll also include links to Jonathan and all of his projects in our show notes as well. And if you've missed previous episodes, definitely take a look at our history of shows and take a look at our recent episodes with Jonathan. And I always love having you on the podcast to talk about work, talk about life, talk about just how we're navigating it. And I do really see, since the very first day we've met up, recorded the podcast, and how we've navigated and just evolved as individuals. I'm really excited and proud to see how we've navigated and grown through it. And so I just want to say thank you, Jonathan, for being on the podcast once again. Really appreciate having you.
Thank you so much, Stephen. I look forward to being here again when Mike Curato releases his next book.
Yes.
We can talk about it.
Yes, we will.
I feel like since it was announced, we can talk about it, but like we can't give away anything. But we would.
No.
That's the thing that we were talking about the last time I was here.
Yeah.
When I was like, the thing we can't talk about. Yeah. And he was like, oh, you were like, ooh, tell me more. And I was like, girl, you are also involved.
But it's announced, but we can't say anything yet. We await everyone to enjoy the splendor of all of our little inputs.
That's going to be very exciting, and that's going to allow me to claim that space that we just talked about, right?
Yes. Maybe that's how it's going to happen. Yeah. And with that, for all of our listeners, hope you enjoyed this episode, and we hope your rest of your day, your weekend, the rest of the month can be a little bit more mindful with some of our input and insights from today. With that, episode's now closed. Hope to see you again next time. Bye.